This meeting today is actually, there's a change to the meeting, so everyone knows. Jeffrey St. Clair is unable to make it at the last minute to speak on carbon trading. And so we're fortunate enough to have Anuradha Mittal from the Oakland Institute. And she's going to be speaking on the food crisis and a bit on the fallacy of the market to address the food crisis, and you know, I think we'll have a good discussion on that topic. My name's Eric. I'm from Seattle, from the International Socialist Organization in Seattle. Welcome everyone to the inaugural West Coast Socialism. Hopefully everyone's having a good weekend so far. We're very excited. Everything's been going really well. I'll talk a little bit about how the discussion is going to work here. But first of all, I'm going to let Anuradha speak for about 35 or so minutes, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion. So without further ado,
thank you. If it's okay, I'll stand. Is that okay? So I can see if you're getting totally bored or I should shut up. But so as an immigrant in this country, I have to say there can be no better way to celebrate July 4th weekend than this conference. So congratulations. I'm assuming you all want to be here and want to know about the policy of free market and solving the food crisis. I obviously don't look like Jeffrey Sinclair, and I am not going to talk about carbon trading. Very relevant topic. It's a pity he's not here. We all heard about the food crisis, 2008 food crisis. Food prices increased by 83% between 2005 and 2008. Thanks to media sensationalizing food riots, people getting killed in third world countries, governments toppling, for instance, in Haiti. For once, hunger was on the front page news. It was not embedded somewhere. Summits were organized last year. Just in Japan, the G8, we talked about food security. I saw some figures about $500 million or something was spent on the conference to talk about food security. Many of us who have worked on global hunger issues for once thought that perhaps this is the time when everyone is so focused on world hunger, something will be done. There was nothing unique in some ways for us about the 2008 food crisis. There has been hunger in the world, and it has been growing. It has been growing by leaps and bounds over the last few years, but it has never attracted attention. It has never had the kind of attention it received last year. However, this attention was very short span. By the middle of last year, when the prices of food grains started going down somewhat, suddenly nobody was talking about it. And of course, the poor and hungry don't have private jets to fly into congressional hearings. So everyone was focused on how to bail out automakers, the economic crisis. So it's been very interesting with the economic crisis that suddenly hunger has disappeared, as if the people who are losing jobs right here in the United States or the poor in developing countries, it's not that they had a few months of hunger and everything's fine and dandy. And in the midst of all this, just a couple of weeks ago, Food and Agriculture Organization announced that 1.2 billion people are now characterized as going to bed hungry every day. Now, in 1996, when the World Food Summit on Hunger was organized, at that time, the number of hungry people was 815 million people. And the government's heads of state said, we will reduce the number of hungry by half by 2015. And as we're in 2009, we have reached the historic record high of 1.2 billion people. You know, when I throw these numbers at you, it doesn't really mean anything. And hunger, too. You know, you and I might have been in the conference. We have continued in a session. It was interesting. We feel hunger, but we avoid it. You know, it's like, but you have the choice. You can walk out, grab a burrito or whatever. I'm talking about something where families, where children, where communities go hungry day after day. And they're making choices that nobody should have to make. I'm talking about young men in villages in India between the ages of 18 and 35. Most of them would have only one kidney. They've made the choice to sell their kidney. You know, it is not an Indian virtue or an Indian value to have child labor. The choice that parents have made to sell their children into prostitution, to be beggars into child labor, it is not an Asian value. it is a choice that a family is making. Or in Brazil, it is not the national pastime to go occupy lands as you battle with private armies of landlords. MST, the movement of landless workers, it is hunger. When shit's hitting the fan, you have no other choice to make. You do what you got to do. So when I talk about 1.2 billion people, a sixth of humanity, by the way, I would say that number underestimates the amount of hunger that we have in this world. I would say nearly half the humanity that lives on less than $2 a day is making very difficult choices, especially in the developing world, where the poor are spending nearly 60 to 80% of their budget on food. And despite prices coming down in developing world, the prices of food grains are still very high, according to the FAO. So hunger has not diminished, it is still there, it is growing, and it is being ignored. Having said that, it's very interesting, when it was so much in the news, even the World Bank, you know, the ex-USTR chief, the U.S. Trade Representative Zolek, who now heads up the World Bank, was running around the different capitals talking about we've got to pay attention to this growing hunger because it's going to topple governments. And then the solution offered was we need more free trade. Pascal Lamy, the French socialist who heads up the World Trade Organization, he was like, we need to conclude the Doha round of the World Trade Organization, because they talk about hunger as merely a problem of food shortage, of demand and supply. The demand is increasing and we need to feed more people. They sound like Monsanto. You go to Monsanto's website, they talk about how technology will increase food production and then everyone will be fine and well-fed and the rest. Not once do they acknowledge that we have enough food to provide 2,400 kilocalories per person per day around the world. Most of us Indians would look kind of chubby if we had that kind of access to food. President Bush talked about, well, we have this food shortage because people in India and China are eating more. It sounds like, wow, isn't liberalization better? Isn't globalization of economy better because those Indians and Chinese are now consuming more because they have more money? Now, you don't expect anything better from him, so you can excuse him. But the fact that USDA and everyone started saying that is a bit of a joke. First of all, when your income increases, suddenly you start can't eating more. What changes is your basket. What changes is what's inside the basket. But a country like India, where culturally people are not going to start eating meat. Yes, consumption of eggs and poultry has gone up, but India is one of the largest producers of poultry and of eggs. China and India are still net exporters of cereals. So talking about increased demand from China and India is taking and causing this food shortages was once again racist kind of explanation, which was basically meant to cover the fact that people are too poor to buy food and that's why hunger is increasing. It's the absence of livable wage jobs. It is the absence of people's and farmers' rights to water, land and seeds that's creating these kind of hunger and poverty. What was really interesting was that in all this discourse, whether it is Gates Foundation or Jeffrey Sachs talking about how to solve hunger, or whether it is your USDA or the World Trade Organization, not once do they really talk about what has caused, what has created this chronic food insecurity in the developing world. Not once that was talked about. So when you pose it as a crisis of demand and supply, the solutions that are offered are obviously broken. So I wanted to look at some of the factors. And we have been working with the G24, the developing countries who came together in the 1970s to concert their monetary fiscal position so they can stand up to World Bank and the others. And it includes countries such as India, South Africa, Brazil, some of the big developing countries. We have been working with them, and they are going to be at the 29th session of UNCTAD stating why there's food security in the developing world. And it's a very exciting moment for us. So on one hand, there were several short-term, very valid factors that are responsible for this food crisis. Speculation. You know, speculation in agricultural futures markets is not a bad thing. It is a good way of ensuring that farmers have sold their their crops before harvest. It has always been good. But thanks to deregulation, Wall Street banks could go and invest in it in unlimited quantities. The speculators were people who were not involved in food processing or production. These were outside non-commercial hedger index funds who were like, oh, The housing market is collapsing. We need another place to put money in. Guess what? Let's put money in agricultural futures. So they caused a lot of ups and downs in prices. There was biofuels, US and Europe especially, diversion of crops such as corn into producing ethanol. The land use changes that took place. For instance, 16% of area that was grown in rice was moved into corn in the US, which resulted in 12% decline in rice production. But these are still short-term factors. So why would suddenly, when US says we are not going to be exporting corn but we use it for ethanol, why does it impact the rest of the world? And that's what's important. We have to see what has happened over the last 30, 40 years that has caused devastation in the third world countries. The first one I would say is there has been this recipe for development that has been promoted by rich donor nations, which has been promoted by the international financial institutions, that we need to have trade liberalization, we need to have deregulation, i.e. make government so small, as the conservatives here would say, that you can drown it in the bathtub. So governments take get out of being involved in agriculture and food. So for instance, I wouldn't be standing here and speaking in front of you if India, when I was growing up in India, did not have a public distribution system. Public distribution system was managed by grain marketing boards. What they would do is they would buy grains for the farmers, assuring them of a fixed price, whether it was a good harvest or a bad harvest. Farmers were not subjected to the market. They were sure of a fixed price that would cover the cost of production plus give a profit. And they would ensure that the consumers, especially low-income consumers, would have access to the necessary of, you know, cereals. For instance, in India, if my family didn't have access to lentils, the main source of protein for the poor, you know, my brothers and I would not be here, would not have survived. Our family was sure of that. And India is not unique. It was, you know, it was there in Indonesia, it was in Malawi called Edmark, so it has been everywhere. But World Bank and the others were, we need to get rid of these institutions. They are corrupt. They are expensive. With trade liberalization, you don't need grain reserves. You are have this huge big, you know, godowns that are storing grains. Get rid of that all. You know, we live in the wonderful free world. And when a country needs it, the grains will come. And what has happened with that is the investment in agriculture has gone. Agriculture has been ignored. The state bodies have been ignored. And they've been removed. And the last year's crisis makes it very obvious that it's not just Iraq, where so many children died during the time of embargo, and of course, our ongoing war. But Cuba, which saw a different kind of war in terms of embargo, food sovereignty, countries having access to their own food grains is not just an economic necessity, but also a political necessity. And last year, when countries in Europe or US decide to do otherwise with their grains, third world countries who have come to depend on these imports basically didn't have access to food and saw the food prices go up. The second reason that I wanted to highlight is removal of agricultural tariffs and import surges. You know, free trade in agriculture is the carrot that was offered to the developing countries that you want to join the WTO, you want to join CAFTA or NAFTA, all these free trade agreements, because you will have access to agricultural markets in the rich countries. Now, what has really happened, as we know, is, say, take the case of NAFTA, that you have heavily subsidized ADM, Continental, Conagra, and then the others, and Cargill, who are competing against the poor campesinas in Mexico who do not have that subsidized support. So basically, it has become a great way of dumping subsidized cheap grains into third world countries. The result is, it is estimated that nearly 500 farmers are displaced from land each day in Mexico thanks to NAFTA. Now, what happens to them? You know, Gates Foundation, which is talking about a new vision of agriculture where the market-oriented farmers and therefore people who are not market-oriented need to get off the land. They call them land mobile. Nobody ever talks about what happens to these land mobile people. It's a euphemism for displacement from land. And yes, these are the brothers and sisters who try to come up, you know, across the borders looking for a better life. And we know what they find. Xenophobic, you know, legislators, laws, arrests, and even death at the border. This has happened, and just to give you some figures, in 2003, the U.S. exported wheat at 28% below the cost of production. It exported cotton at 47% below the cost of production, and rice 26% below the cost of production. So very often we think U.S. can export and capture markets because it is efficient, it is industrialized. No such thing. It's the taxpayers' money, which is basically bailing out these big corporations. This flood of cheap imports which have come into developing countries, especially in Africa, has had devastating impact. People have been displaced from land. And just again, what many of you might not realize, in 1960s, developing countries were net food exporters. And their trade surplus of agriculture was $7 billion. By 70s, because a lot of pressure was coming from World Bank and IMF and the structural adjustment loans were kicking in, it was already going down and the trade surplus had come down to $1 billion. And you jump to 2001, their trade deficit in agriculture is $11 billion. So from $7 billion, you have turned it into enormous markets. And the myth of it all is when you go to a country like India and promise international markets for farmers, it's a bit of a joke. Here's a country of a billion people. We have a market right there. You don't need a market outside. You're turned into an exotic fruit basket, which is growing. Punjab, the granary of India, is growing flowers for export. You know, you go into Trader Joe's, you find those little tin roses. Guess where they've come from? They've come from India, from the most fertile land. This is the promise of free trade, which does not feed people. Experience of Ghana is very similar. A country which was very focused on achieving self-sufficiency in the 60s was doing very well. Come 70s, 80s, a lot of pressure from the World Bank, IMF, and by 2003, you see that Ghana's rice imports had increased from 250,000 tons from 1998 to 416,000 tons by 2003, an increase of 70%. 66% of the rice growers, they reported loss and they reported they were moving out of agriculture. 66% of rice growers in Ghana. And in the same year, 2003, the U.S. government provided domestic rice subsidies worth $1.3 billion. So just a food agricultural system which is totally upside down and backwards. Rice growing in Calcutta, in California, you know where my heart is, Calcutta. It's growing in California as we talk about drought and we're talking about a water guzzling crop. It's totally subsidized so it can be below the cost of production and then sent to places like India. Ghana's poultry sector was also devastated by cheap subsidized poultry that came in from Europe. So here is a country which could feed itself, was focused on self-sufficiency by 2004. That's totally out of the window, dependent on imports that are coming in from US and Europe and at their mercy. Shift to export crops, that has been the big cash cow that has been sold to the third world countries. An estimated 43 developing countries, of which most are LDCs, least developing countries, today depend on a single commodity, cocoa, coffee, flowers, for a majority of the export revenue. The problem with that model is, as we all know, that the prices of commodities are very volatile. You can take the case of Uganda, which was a great disciple of the World Bank, made all the changes, moved on to coffee. 2002, world coffee prices plummeted, and the entire national economy was devastated, not to mention the impact at the household level. So this is the, you know, model of agriculture that has been sent around the world, which has devastated ability of nations to produce crops. So food and agriculture, instead of being about feeding families, communities, nations, has turned into a commodity. It is really about trading in commodities. And this whole myth that free trade is going to bring prosperity to the third world, it hasn't happened. It will not happen if you look at the last farm bill. And it is basically going to create a model of agriculture that you have in the US. You know, we have at least heard about farmer suicides in India. I mean, even the Indian government publicly acknowledges that between 1997 and 2007, nearly 182,000 farmers have taken their own lives. Farmers who have been put on the treadmill of chemical-based industrial agriculture, who had to take debts because the entire public system and support system has been demolished. And then when you have nothing but a debt and no crop and no market, there's only one choice left. That is to take your own life. At the same time, from Gates Foundation to Ban Ki-moon, who heads up the United Nations, to just what every Western agency talks about, perhaps we need to reduce dependence on agriculture. I have asked United Nations, I've written to the Gates Foundation, nobody responds. If they are hiring, where are these millions of people supposed to go? They do never reply. You look at the strategy report, agricultural development strategy report of the Gates Foundation, which is big time in agriculture, which is joining up with the US government to the Food and Agriculture Organization. You ask them that you're promoting moving people out of agriculture, but where are these people supposed to go? They don't have an answer. The 100-and-some page report doesn't want to say, what do you do with these people? Indian government's practicing the same. However, what you don't hear about is that the biggest cause of death among farmers in the United States is suicide as well. The rates of shame, depression, alcoholism are so high among the U.S. farmers. In 1930s, 25% of U.S. population was in agriculture. Today, you have more people behind bars than behind the wheel of a tractor. And this is a nation which is selling or promoting agricultural strategy to the rest of the developing world. It's a broken cookie. Thank you very much. Keep it for yourself. What do we do? You know, it's very interesting in the midst of all this food crisis when free trade and genetic engineering as a solution and everything has been peddled. At the same time, in April last year, ISTAT, this international assessment of agriculture, science, technology that was done. It was the first time something like this had happened. It was financed by the World Bank, by the FAO, United Nations Environmental Program. All these folks were involved in it. And what the report came out in April was agreed upon and signed on very soon by like 60 governments, of course not by the United States. It clearly said that business as usual is not the answer. It talked about the importance of biodiversity. It talked about the small family farms practicing sustainable agriculture. It clearly said that if you want to solve hunger, genetic revolution is not the answer. And nowhere in all these summits, ISTAT report is mentioned. You know, all this money was spent and it's now gathering dust somewhere. It's not talked about as if it never happened. Because in the multi-stakeholder, the corporations who were part of it towards the end got very pissed off because it would not say that genetic engineering is the solution to world's hunger. It was upset that it was saying, hey, it doesn't have much role to play. They were very upset they're not talking about it. Instead, what we have is, once again, even under Barack Obama, we can talk about Bush, but under the new administration, U.S., next week, when the G8 again meet in Italy in a very big, fancy show that's going to be held next week, U.S. is going to make a big commitment to solve hunger. It's going to put forward $4 billion on the table, hoping the other nations will add in too. And what will it do? Once again, promote free trade. Once again, promote genetic revolution. In preparation for the summit, an agricultural summit was held in April. And Secretary of Agriculture, Vilsack, who travels around in Monsanto's planes, he came back and said, well, we have to look at technology. And soon after that, we have a thing called the Global Food Security Act. It sounds very good. Charities such as Oxfam are supporting it as well, unfortunately. But what the Global Food Security Act does, that in the name of aid, for the first time, research and genetic engineering is going to be a part of U.S. aid. So African nations, for instance, who have said no to GE food aid in 2002, a small nation like Zambia had basically said, get lost, United States. Either give us GM-free corn or we don't want your food aid. U.S. at that time, in fact, their representative to the FAO, Tony something, wanted Zambia to be taken before the International Criminal Court. You had to say, hey, U.S. does not believe in the International Criminal Court. They were glad to take Zambia there. There were articles in every newspaper about Zambia violating people's right to food. Guess what? Zambia did just fine. It managed to get non-genetically engineered food aid. In fact, it increased its own food production that next year, World Food Program was buying food from Zambia for distribution in Africa where food was needed. It did just fine. So what U.S. is not trying to do is, because all these little mice, it's like the mouse that roared, they keep roaring up and standing up to our policies, so let's make it a part of U.S. aid. And that bill is sitting in the Senate, and a similar bill is being introduced now in the House of Representatives. So this is what our money is going to be used for, to basically break dissent, to break opposition to genetically engineered crops, but more important, to influence farming and agricultural agenda in third world countries. And I'll end by saying that, you know, food sovereignty is a concept that La Via Campesina, which is the world's smallest farmers movement, but also the largest, is the largest movement of small family farmers in the world. They came forward with this concept of food sovereignty, which is the right of all nations, all people, and all communities to decide how food is grown, what is grown, and how it is used. So basically taking back your own food system. It says there cannot be any patents on life. You know, in the U.S. we're used to buying seeds, but nearly a billion farmers around the world, they have protected their own seeds, and they use the seeds of the harvest for the next planting. They don't go and buy seeds. So it says you cannot privatize seeds, because if you control the seed system, you control the entire food system. They're challenging that. It is about farmers' rights to land, to water, and to seeds. I mean, as we speak right now, World Bank and others are promoting this win-win situation, which is rich countries can go and buy land in poor nations. It used to be United States with its banana plantations in the Philippines to Latin America, but now the Chinese, Saudi Arabia, India, everyone is going and buying up land in Africa so they can grow their food, they can grow their biofuels. What will the people eat? This is not just about land. Agriculture has been most sacred because this is where majority of the world's poor depend and live on. 75% of the world's poor, who are called poor, are small family farmers. So it doesn't take rocket science. If you want to impact poverty, if you want to challenge hunger, you focus on the small family farmers. You assure them a decent livelihood. You assure them their own local regional markets. Forget this myth of, long-distance industrial agriculture, which destroys our biodiversity and which is one of the biggest contributors to climate change. So we know how to feed people, we know how to clothe people, we know how to provide a shelter to everyone. So I would say the challenge here that we can talk about in a discussion is, how do we remove those in power who prevent that from happening? We know how to do all that. You know, it's not that we need some kind of great scientific revolution where people in white coats and labs will figure out how to feed the world. People who have never gone to schools and colleges are farmers. You know, they are the best stewards of the land. They are the best protectors of biodiversity. They are the ones who have come up with all the different varieties that we have before us. So the challenge is how to get the corporations out of our stomach. How do we get the corporations out of our airwaves and media and the lies that we are seeing from NPR to New York Times, where Monsanto has all the same, all of the space? Or your supermarket to the world, which is really, ADM. So it's really about taking back our life, our nations, and our land, and that's where the solution lies. That was a very good dramatic ending. Thank you. There are some reports. Oakland Institute is an independent policy think tank. We do research, we do analysis, and what's really cool about us is that we feed that information directly to third world governments with the hope that despite arm twisting and being pushed against the wall, they can stand up and at least have their own analysis to challenge the lies that the armies of trade negotiators give to them. So grab a copy of a report, share it. If you know of people who will be interested, there's a latest one, Voices from Africa, which really takes on Gates Foundation and Jeffrey Sachs' Millennium Villages Challenge, that where the solutions for feeding poor people are, so we can challenge this white prescription for a black continent. So grab those reports, and if you're interested in knowing action alerts and latest reports that we're putting out, sign up for our listserv. I'll send these around. Thank you.
And all those brochures are in the back, so people can check those out on their way out. We do have a lot of time for discussion. We have a good 45 minutes or so. So I encourage questions, comments. Just go ahead and raise your hand, and I'll call on you as I see your hands go up. We'll try to get through the list. And, you know, feel free to try to answer each other's questions and make comments, and we'll see exactly how this will work. But I saw right in the back here first, and then everybody else with your hand up, just keep your hand up for a minute until I point to you.
I was a little bit late, so I hope you've been already discussed this, but I've been thinking a lot about the obesity thing that's going around, with people that are seriously obese, but I have not run into anybody who's done sort of a study of where that's showing up, because I'm sure it's either genetically modified food or additives. I think it's a GE thing. So I was curious if there's any studies that kind of show the pattern of where it's appearing the most.
Mm-hmm. Right here in the white shirt.
There's two facts I don't really know how they fit together. One thing you said, like the due to subsidies in rich countries, United States, Europe, food is really cheap, or like the prices are cheaper than, for example, Mexico. Also in other countries, they export to other countries. On the other hand, we have a problem of too high food prices, which caused, which we call the food crisis. So what is the actual problem
here? Yeah, I've got the sister by the door. Next, followed by the man in gray right here.
My name's Jasmine. I just graduated from the Sanitas as an environmental studies major, and I'm very interested, and I've been doing a lot of research on the investments that go into these major multinational corporations that are causing this environmental degradation and human exploitation, and the food crisis and so forth. And I want to know how, as consumers, or as people in this country, the developed world, how can we fight back in like how we choose to make our consumption preferences and choices? Like, for instance, buying General Mills, buying GMO products, buying things that are made from Monsanto and Cargill and things of that nature, just like buying into this whole market system, right? When stocks are being offered for these corporations, and the higher the prices, and the more profit they make, the more profit the ruling class makes. So, like, how can we, as like a movement,
to
tackle these problems of investing into corporations that are being environmentally degrading and socially
exploited. Great. So here in the gray shirt, followed by
the
woman next to you in the red.
I'm James. I live in Los Angeles. When you were talking about small-scale farmers and the need for how that's a solution to the global food crisis is to get rid of large-scale farming and have family farms to the local markets. When we talk about other products besides food, I generally don't hear a lot of discussion among socialists of going back to artisanal production and small-scale local workshops. I think the model generally is for workers to control the current system of production and distribution. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if there's something special about food that makes the artisanal production system more necessary.
Mm-hmm. Great question. So after you, I've got the sister from Austin.
I'm just curious about the example you gave with Zambia, where they declined the genetically modified corn. Can you talk a little bit about, was that the actual political leadership that it had, and was it through pressure from citizens of Zambia? And then how likely is that to be repeated in other countries, or is often the political system either corrupt enough or just whatever, that we'll go ahead and accept that kind of offer?
We got a lot of questions. Do you want to come back in a minute? Do you want?
Okay.
I'll call one more.
Okay.
I'm going to call one more person, and I think we'll have Anuradha come back on some of these questions. So, sister from Austin.
You mentioned that the futures market at one time you felt was helpful in some way because it provided a sure market. I just totally disagree. To me, that's a capitalist construct that invites gambling in the system, and now the gambling is just so much more extreme that it's worse than it ever was. And basically, if I buy pork belly futures, I want them to, I'm buying them low, and I'm hoping that they'll really get much more expensive so that I can make a great profit. And the whole problem here is to me, obviously, capitalism. The system is based on getting profits, and instead of what people really need. And you wouldn't need a futures market because you wouldn't grow enough grain, you know, surplus grain or whatever for pork bellies that you didn't really need. And so, I mean, the whole gambling system, derivatives, hedge funds, all that stuff, that's got to go. I mean, that would do tremendous things, I think, to save the capitalist system, but I don't want to do that. But, yeah, seriously. And on the obesity crisis, I think the villain now is showing up to be high fructose corn syrup that creates a, you know, more demand for sugar, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm a teacher in Texas, and I was reading a paper, reading a restaurant review in my class one day, and I'm reading, this place serves Mexican Coke. And most of my students are Latino. I said, what's Mexican Coke? And they knew instantly, it's got real sugar in it. You know, and one, you know, Mexico, which is this third world country that we're having, you know, having all this problem, why can they do this? And we can't, you know, because it's much cheaper. You can make much more profit on high fructose corn syrup. So the system's got to go. I mean, it really does. And
same. Okay, so if you want to come back and try to get some of these questions.
Well, just to tackle obesity, I think it's a symptom of undernourishment. You know, Heritage Institute and others use that to say there's no poverty in the country because so-called poor people are fat. Actually, I've debated somebody from there on NPR who actually said that. I could not believe it. But it is the kind of diet that is made available to people. I mean, you go to a low-income area and you see what's there. Do you have, you know, food stores that are selling affordable food, which is healthy? Or do you have liquor stores where they will have food which is full of corn syrup and the rest? Or your choice of for $1, you can buy 4 wings of chicken. Like I saw where I lived, you know, I was shocked. But, I mean, because there's this whole concept of cheap food, whatever you put inside your stomach and you're fine. So it's actually a symptom of undernourishment. And it's also about, you know, how detached in the United States people have been made from their own food. So the idea is of cheap food. You know, there's nothing cheap about food. I mean, talk about an extractive industry. You know, it takes a lot to grow food. But we have a very exploitative system where hardly anything goes to the farmer. If you look at that white bread, which it sells for like 99 cents, 5 or 6 cents go to the farmer. Where does the rest of the money go? So if, you know, as a socialist, if you don't care about your food system, actually there's a problem because there's somebody who's being exploited, earth, nature is being exploited, and somebody is getting richer while the others are getting poorer. In terms of obesity, there's several studies that are there. As you know, it is one of the highest priorities even of actually any kind of medical institution. It's causing major concern, the kind of obesity we have in the United States. So you will find a lot of research. But also it's about our school systems. I'm shocked that in schools you would have vending machines that are giving Coca-Cola and then sodas. You know, it's for me, I mean, you might as well put, you know, selling cigarettes and, I mean, and the rest. So you can't drink alcohol. I would rather be like France where you can have alcohol, legal age is 18. But here you can provide soda to like 3-4 year olds. I mean, you can get it from the schools, and many of the schools that you go, you will find them. In Los Angeles, for instance, I found out that there's a law which bans it, but if people are not watching, the soda machines are back there. So it's really also a lot about vigilance on our own part and what we are doing with our own food system. Subsidies, it's a very interesting food system that we think we have cheap food because it is subsidized. The taxpayers' money does not go to the small family farmers in the U.S. It is not going to the California farmers, specialty growers, who are seriously hurting right now. It goes to the big corporations who are putting out our food, and we buy it. And so in terms of, somebody asked about what do we do as consumers, I would first say it's time we stop thinking of ourselves as consumers. You know, when I think of consumers, I think of tuberculosis, consumption. I mean, fire consumes. We need to have a very different relationship because food is very personal. You know, it goes right inside us. It's not something that we make a choice about. We need it for survival. At the same time, it's very political. When you and I reach out and get something from a market shelf, we are making a political decision about how it is grown, who produced it, what the farm workers were paid. You know, I've been talking about the small family farmers. We haven't even talked about the farm workers and their conditions. I mean, in this country, a sector where children can work as child labor is farming. So, you know, it's It's all of that, and that's why we need to care what goes inside us. And, you know, thankfully things are changing. I'm a little tired when people last year were saying, well, with the food crisis, now people will just go local and everyone will rush to the farmers' markets. You know, it is an issue when your tomatoes are $4 a pound. I mean, given with economic recession. So let's get, you know, real about it too. Our fight for food justice will start from, say, food stamps, which is the first line of defense in this country against hunger. When you get $28 or some a week, go figure what kind of food you're going to buy. When you have to feed a family, you're not going to be choosing kind of, are you going to get milk that is free of bovine growth hormone? I mean, nowhere else in the world people have to pay less for polluting earth, air, and water. We need to fight back and say corporations which kill our earth, air, and water, which are killing our bodies, our children, they should have to pay. Mm-hmm. You know, the organic dairy farmers are going out of business because of the economic recession. People are not buying organic milk. That's a terrible tale, that people who are taking care of our environment, that are taking care of our bodies, they are fine, whereas Monsanto, the producer of RBGH, and the others are doing well. So our battle will start from there to everything else.
If maybe we could just kick it out for a few more questions and then we'll come back.
One great website I did want to mention, True Food Network. If you care about what goes inside you and if it has GMOs, it lets you know, for example, Pepperidge Farm that you think must be good because you pay so much for it, it's full of genetically modified organisms. And the great thing about this website, it gives you alternatives, what you can buy. So check that out.
What was the name of the website again?
True Food Network.
And we'll come back again here. I've got quite a few people on the list, so I do want to try to hear from everyone here. Try to keep people's comments to about 2.5 minutes, so we can start to get through some of the list here. I've got gentleman in green here, and then I've got right here in the front.
Yeah, you know, I can answer the question about the futures market. I mean, you're right. We live in a capitalist society, so it's a form of speculation. In America, the futures market was a progressive thing that was set up in the 1920s and 30s. A lot of it was organized by the Grange and by the farmers' associations in order to assure, historically in America, farmers would have to sell to the speculator who came down the road, who would always buy low and always sell high. The future markets actually allow farmers to hold on to their grain and get a guaranteed price point. They function as a private version, a little bit, of what the public boards in India, mm-hmm. which I didn't even know existed, actually, but the way you described it, it's very much like a future market. Yes, it's capitalist, but you know what? So are wages. And all I'm fighting for in my union is to be a
right.
better paid wage.
That's right. Right.
Now, but that really doesn't go to the, I mean, you're right, now with these future markets, 2,000 board of grain, they're terrible. I mean, they've become corporatized, deregulated, mm-hmm. so now the speculators are back in control, not walking down the road with their wagon, but on the internet and through the investment bank and hedge funds and so forth.
Thank you.
So that's really what, in a historical context, what the futures is about, the futures market. And of course, they have futures now in everything. They have futures in electricity, which is my industry. They have futures in, it's really a bad thing now. But subsidies is a rather interesting thing because, and it's maybe you can answer this thing. I mean, historically on the left in the United States, that means the 1950s and before, we always fought, the socialist movement fought for subsidies for farmers, which usually meant the dairy farmers you were talking about. I mean, before the 1950s, all food was organic. You know, my parents never eat food. Nitrates was the big inorganic thing, because that's what you put in bacon. Everything else was organic. So, you know, I still want to see family farmers get a subsidy rather than seeing them go out of business, but I don't want to see the speculator come down the road and have to be able to buy that product and that rice, for example, and send it to India so that it at below cost, so that it can be then put out, you know, farmers who grow basmati rice who can't even own the name basmati anymore. That kills me. It's owned by
Protexmati.
Can you wrap up?
Yeah. So I was wondering, why is it that my question to you is, why is it that the United States would fight subsidies in every other country in the world, subsidizes its own agriculture, yet nobody ever takes them to the WTO, or do they? I mean, I don't know about it.
That's great.
Okay. And so what happens?
So I've got right here, followed by right next to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think somebody, asked a question about how do we intervene with these problems of world hunger. I mean, not only was there this well-publicized crisis last year, but it's a crisis that led to struggles in dozens of countries, put tremendous pressure on the Preval government in Haiti, interacted with a pro-Palestinian and union movement in Egypt. The global hunger crisis led to a big upsurge in struggle in those countries, and that's obviously part of the answer. I mean, one of the answers, the most direct thing that probably most of us have already been involved in, and we should be proud about this, is the global justice movement itself. Because what I think a big part of what Anurada was pointing out is how the framework for the corporate invasion of agriculture, the creation of unsustainable agricultural systems that then ruin small farmers who are practicing in a more sustainable way prior to that, the framework for that is the WTO, the World Bank, and the IMF. That's what creates the legal and financial big picture that has greatly accelerated these neoliberal trends around the world in the last year. So when the global justice movement was at its height a few years ago, protesting the WTO and these other international organizations, it led to things like the free trade area of the Americas was killed. Partly because it was publicly discredited, partly because it gave some support to poorer countries, which although they have a capitalist class which was partly interested in these agreements, it also had other interests that made them not as clearly on the favorably receiving end of neoliberal changes. So, I mean, I think we've seen the global justice movement have a very positive effect. We'd be seeing these trends happening at a much faster rate if the FTAA was in existence today, and we don't see that. Right. So I think that's the kind of thing that we need to build on and extend. And in doing it, I think our traditions, when we started historically as Marxists trying to organize a working class in factories where the means of production are already collectivized, so it's already in the direct economic interest of that initial base of people to go to socialism and away from markets. But we understand in a world and in countries where there's a farming majority or a large farming sector, that's not in their direct economic interest, at least not right away. So I think what we're actually fighting for in terms of keeping the corporations out is autonomy for the small farming sector. We want an alliance between farmers, between peasants mm-hmm. and workers, based on the recognition of the different interests between those. But it's not about favoring capitalism in the long run. I think we're in favor of small farmers being able to collectivize and cooperatize over the long term on their own, based on incentives and on their own terms.
Great, thanks. Okay, so after the sister right here, we got right here in the Krabulous shirt.
My name is Patrick. I live in the
After.
Oh, sorry, I didn't hear
that. That's okay. My name is Sandra. I live in San Mateo. And the only thing I buy at Safeway is Dobie pads to wash my dishes. And I'm primarily an organic food consumer, and when people tell me that's an elitist position and organic food is too expensive, I think it's a whole lot more expensive to eat at McDonald's and buy processed food than it is to buy natural food. I'm fortunate that I have a large garden, and the rest of my produce comes from community-supported agriculture so that farmers can get their retail prices for their food, and I think that's the best way to support small local farmers. It's even better than farmers markets. And we're fortunate that we're in one area of the country that we can do that. There's lots of places that don't, but it's really growing all over the country, community-supported agriculture. And I'd be curious as why it's so important to have small farms as opposed to nut workshops and that he was talking about for mm-hmm. for other things. And
all right, so I've got a pretty full list here. I'm going to try to work our way through it. I'm going to try to keep you maybe closer to 2 minutes now so we can try to get through it. There's still a number of people who haven't spoken yet. So if you have already spoken, I'm just going to wait to call on you again until we hear from everybody else. So after the brother in the blue shirt here, I've got Ashley.
Hey, Patrick, I'll try to be quick. I've got some questions for you and also just something to tell you all about. I'm wondering, in countries where there has been liberalization, what are successful means that of stabilizing, trying to go back and stabilize that, prices for agricultural commodities, beyond maybe protectionism, and I don't know if you all are familiar with Rodale, an old, in, in the U.S., they're the oldest organic agriculture organization. They've been pushing, they have this scheme where they want to substitute for agricultural subsidies, they want to substitute, you know, carbon credits. And, you know, it seems like, you know, right now that the powers are aligned behind the whole cabin trade. You know, hopefully a carbon tax might be something that would work better. You know, what we really need is, you know, some form of agrarian form, agrarian reform. I don't know what that would look like here in the United States. And in terms of climate change mitigation, I think one of the more than a lot of the energy things, if we can somehow get rid of pathos, of factory farms, that would be huge in terms of reducing emissions. And the alternative to that, if we were actually to progressive rotational grazing, perennial pasture, low-till, no-till agriculture, that's going to be huge in fighting climate change. Mm-hmm.
You could wrap up.
Okay, there's one thing in Oakland that is very exciting. It's the Oakland Food Policy Council that's trying to move from on a policy level, move towards a local, socially just food movement. And there's one group that I like that has a social justice oriented, conscription. That's all.
Great, thanks. So after Ashley, I've got right here in the front, and I just want to remind people, I mean, there were a lot of questions about, you know, genetically engineered crops. What do we say about that? More on the question of, you know, as how do we respond as individual consumers versus how do we build movements? Are those counterposed? Are they not? There's been a lot of discussion about that, and then also the question of farm workers, which I think somebody brought up that would also probably be worth addressing. So I just want to put that out there. Those are all topics here that we've got for this conversation. So I've got Ashley and then take care.
I really like the way Anuradha posed it, that, you know, I think we need to stop looking at ourselves as simply consumers of food and actually start looking at food as a human right, something that belongs to all of us, so we can take a stand against multinational corporations like Monsanto that claim they have intellectual property rights over seeds, these same, you know, seeds that will then actually, like, destroy farmers that aren't using farmers oftentimes in areas where they'll start using the genetically modified seeds, it will, like, they'll basically, like, kill out people that aren't using those seeds, or then try to, you know, there's all these extra legal, like, methods that Monsanto and other corporations use to try and hoard, like, intellectual property rights of food. And just even, like, in our own communities, I mean, I think it's time for a start that we actually start to, like, democratize the idea of good food and fight for that as a right. Like, I work in the public schools, and here in San Francisco, you know, where there's all these organic markets everywhere where, oh, great, I have a choice to buy a $4 a pound of tomatoes while I can only get 20 hours of work a week. That's a joke. And I live in a city. I don't have a garden. Like, if someone has that garden, I'm happy for them. Everyone has a right to that garden. And I think what we need to begin to fight for is, like, you know, I go to the schools, and oftentimes the lunch entree is something like pizza sticks. It's not even a real slice of pizza. It's a pizza stick, like some warped appetizer, deep fried thing. And that's the regular entree on preschool lunch menus. And that's how more than half of, you know, that's a regular food source for more than half of, you know, urban youth here. And I think it's time for us to fight for things like that as a right. And I think that that's the way that we're really going to transform, you know, the way food is made and consumed, you know, in this country, is to fight for it as a democratic right and a demand for ordinary and working people, not simply like a personal choice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So after you, I've got Alan.
My name is Tanya
Camargo,
and I live in Richmond, California. Well, I've been really getting to the community gardens and, like, how do we build more gardens in Richmond, especially because we're really low income, but most of our dirt is poisonous because of the Chevron refinery in Richmond, so we're kind of, like, having to battle that out, but then, that's the whole thing, but, like, me, because I talk to a lot of people who talk about revolution and stuff, and, like, me, I look at my community, I'm like, if I'm going to convince these people that we can do a revolution, what if the capitalists decide that they want to cut off all the, you know, food that's coming from foreign countries, then what? you know? So it's kind of like, and then when I tell people that, like, we should build more community gardens, we should depend on our neighbors, not the store, we should, they're like, well, we already have corporations already put millions of dollars to, like, let food rot, you know? So it's like, do we fight for that food that's letting be rot, or do we fight for more community gardens? And that's kind of, like, I don't work for community gardens, but, like, you know, which is, like, there's all that food to be rot, so kind of like, what's the best choice to fight for? You know, what fight should I fight?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got Alan followed by the gentleman here.
I'm Alan from Chicago. I want to say something about the subsidy question, I guess, that I was asking about that here, because I don't know the exact history. I know that there are people here who do know it, but it'd be interesting to know that. But there is no way that a subsidy system that was based on small farmers is what we're facing today. The subsidy system has been twisted and bent all out of shape by the agribusiness mm-hmm. interests who dominate. And those are the people who benefit, by and large, from all of this, through the basis of, you know, factory farming on the production end of things to the distribution end, which involves dumping in large scales. And that's why I think it's important to take that into account when we talk about the idea of sort of local movements and stuff, yeah. you know, in terms of food production here. Because that doesn't answer the question about what we're doing about the dumping of U.S. agricultural product at below market prices around the world, right? Not for the benefit of small farmers primarily, but for the benefit of agribusiness. I think this is a really important question about that. I think that point about not seeing ourselves as consumers that you made is absolutely right about that. I think that's really important. We have to see ourselves instead as political and social activists, because that's mm-hmm. how we take on what the real problem is here. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not about our lifestyle choices as much as it is when you start to look at it in that context that you were mapping out about the bigger picture. And I wonder if I could ask you to talk about this in the context of some of the global justice activism, since I heard you first talk about it 10 years ago in Washington, at the height of the global justice movement in 1999 and 2000, you know, talking about, for example, of the No Sweatshop movement, right? The fight against sweatshop labor, where the argument was not about boycotting so much, you know, so that we could be morally pure or something, so much as it was about using campaigns against Nike and so forth to build pressure on those companies to meet labor standards in less developed countries, mm-hmm. and to begin to try to figure out a way, and the global justice movement grappled with this, to figure out a way of how you shift these international political and social economic institutions. I mean, that's a huge question, and it really is about the struggle for a different kind of society altogether. That's how these things, I think, you know, all come together when it comes to the struggle for labor and so forth.
Great, thank you. So I think what I'm going to do here, because we still do have a little bit of time after you speak here, maybe I'll give it back to you for another few minutes, and then we'll come back. There's a couple people who haven't spoken yet who we'll call on, a couple people that have spoken that have raised their hands. So maybe I'll take a last round of hands. If anybody else wants to get on the list, wants to say anything, comments, questions, go ahead, raise your hand, and we'll see if we can get you in here. But I'll let you go.
Can you talk a little bit about how exporting food affects the water supply?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let you go for a few minutes.
God, there's so much, so I'll try to be disciplined. If any of your questions are left, you know, I'm happy to talk to you, and I'm glad you pointed out about the futures markets. I will not address that. I do want to address your question about Zambia. Zambia was an interesting case because it was not just the government that says, okay, some charismatic leader, I'm going to stand up to the U.S. It was a national process where farmers' organizations to scientists to regulatory agencies, unlike in this country who are fast asleep at the wheel, they all came together, sessions were held, scientific evidence was brought in, the economists were brought in to not just look at the health implications or to hear from farmers what the impact on farmers would be, but they looked at the economics of it. What would happen to the exports to Europe, for instance. And they all realized that this push on Africa is really, Africa is being made a pawn in the struggle between U.S. and Europe over GM foods. Mm-hmm. And they basically decided through their own process that they did not want to contaminate the food supply. And Zambia was not unique. Mozambique, Zimbabwe, they all stood up and they challenged genetically modified food aid. India which is a joke. India did not need food aid. And Church World Relief, for instance, was putting pressure on Indian government because India is home to almost half of the world's hungry population, shamefully, though it's the third largest exporter of food in the world, to accept food aid and GM food aid. But the civil society put a lot of pressure back. And, you know, I do want to address one word that you used, that corrupt governments. It's very interesting when we talk about failure of policy in third world countries, we immediately talk about corruption. We never talk about corruption. It is so legalized in this country, which allows for elected governments to be dismissed, where if U.S. does not like a democratically elected government, they think people are fools, they don't know how to vote. And bad governments and corrupt governments who are basically on the payrolls of the U.S. government are put in place. So I think we really have to, in terms of what we do, make it a local global struggle. On one hand, having community-supported agriculture, getting connected with your food system, fighting at the school district level to make sure our kids have access to healthy, nutritious food. It's all valid, as valid it is to march with farmers from around the world. I mean, there are lessons to be learned, I think, especially around food. I mean, I'm very proud that while I talk about farmer suicides, my country farmers used pickaxes to destroy Cargill building because it was destroying their livelihoods. And they were practicing what Gandhi would call, you know, nonviolent satyagraha. Of course, in the U.S., destruction of property is like, I mean, go figure. But that was nonviolent struggle. Nobody was hurt other than the building where that offices of a corporation would be housed, which is destroying livelihoods. Mm-hmm. You know, WTO, it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned about the struggle against the free trade area of the Americas. But it is a monster, Dracula, which keeps raising its head. And we have to keep bringing it into the sun and shine the light on it. You know, WTO, it is a people's movement that this damn thing hasn't moved forward. You know, we defeated it in Seattle. The only time it moved forward was in Doha in November 2001 because U.S. policy was either you're with us or against us after 9/11. And it was in trade policy as well. And so it moved forward when a lot of pressure was put. I was working with the ministers of India when they got a call from the Prime Minister's office saying, they just got a call from the White House. You will not have access to aid. Back off. India was the knight in shining armor in the talks, fighting on behalf of developing countries. Then it was Cancun. The talks collapsed when the Kenyan minister walked out. Then there was Hong Kong, where really no progress was made. And since then, they haven't had a ministerial. But guess what? They're getting ready to have a ministerial in Geneva in November this year. Because they're going to use the economic crisis. They're going to use the goodwill around U.S. because Bush is out.
Right.
It is harder for us to organize around Barack Obama. Let's get our act together now. And what are we fighting for? We are fighting for developing countries to have policy space to determine for themselves how they feed the people. We are talking about countries being able to impose export restrictions like India, Vietnam, and others did last year because they had to prioritize feeding the poor people in their own country instead of exporting the crops, which everyone said, this is terrible, and they all came down on these developing countries. They're trying to introduce things within the WTO which would take away the ability to impose export restrictions, for instance. We have to give developing countries the right to mark products as special products, to put in place special safeguard mechanisms. This is what democracy looks like. So countries can administer on their behalf of their own people. And we need to support that struggle. And there's much we can do when we're calling our senators, when we're calling the legislators. And I'm so glad you talk about the farm subsidies. How many people in the U.S. know about the farm bill? I mean, I've lived in this country now for a decade. Most people, I mean, I'm surprised. I know much more about that stuff than most Americans do. And farm subsidies are not just bad for my part of the world. They're terrible for this country. And I don't see change coming soon because people who head up the agriculture industry are controlling our Congress and Senate so bad that even when you try to change the food aid programs, which is a pathetic small amount of money that could be used to buy food aid directly in third world countries, they clearly say if you try to prevent it where the farmers, where food aid is bought directly in the U.S., is packed in the U.S. and is shipped in U.S. vessels, so all the money that's given comes back to the U.S., and destroys livelihoods of farmers in third world countries. They say you want to touch it, we will get rid of our food aid programs. They've been on record saying that. So we have a big monster to fight. So we have to fight the battle in the belly of the beast, and that's the best way both locally and globally, we can support the food justice movement. And I'll wrap up by saying, you know, we can't give up this struggle. This is very personal. I don't know if you were in Cancun when Lee Keng-hae climbed up wearing the sandwich board and stabbed himself to death saying WTO kills farmers. It's not a slogan. It's not rhetoric. It is killing farmers. His daughter was getting married that way. Wow. You know, when they were breaking down the trade barriers in Hong Kong and the South Korean farmers were jumping into the water to try to get the convention center where livelihoods of people are being traded and bartered away, and they can't get there, there's a problem. So what was beautiful about Seattle was it really made it a global justice movement. And I think the challenge and call I would put out on behalf of the people I'm working with once again, will the people of the United States please stand up? Take back the nation and take back the communities around the world, and that's what we got to do. Do it whichever way, the green way, the socialist way, but you got to do it.
So we still have time. That wasn't the end. I hope you didn't think it would let out that easily. We still got some time here. So I've got, is it Catherine right here?
So my name's Catherine. I live in Berkeley, where my kids go to public schools that are served organic food. And they have a gardening program, and they actually harvest stuff out of the garden. And my kids can name, out of kindergarten, they can name 5 different kinds of apples. And, you know, it's a good thing because... and they also changed the free breakfast program to try to destigmatize it, so every kid has free breakfast. It's a healthy one. It's not hot Cheetos. Hot Cheetos are a lot more per penny. Nutrition per penny from hot Cheetos is a lot more expensive than, you know, like organic yogurt. So, you know, that's exciting. I go into my neighborhood. It's a working class family neighborhood. Sometimes drug dealers run through it, but we have these new traffic circles. And now that it's summer, I see corn and artichokes growing in the traffic circles. There's a community garden at the end of my block, and another community garden 2 blocks down that works on hiring people that live in the neighborhood to try and teach them a skill. These are all small efforts, and I think that what's important, though, is what, I mean, and there can be a range of politics behind these efforts, right? There can be the politics that says, this is a lifestyle, it's just important to be local, to be good consumers, you know, to do what you can on a small scale, but at least, or there could be the politics that are like, we've got to make this a movement on a global scale. But these stand as things in our lives and in our neighborhoods that can begin to make change and begin to build awareness. And I would say that that's important. We need to struggle on all levels. I'm inspired by the efforts in LA to like break concrete and have a community garden against the wishes of, you know, the municipal officials. But the thing I really wanted to talk about is that the amount of money we pay for corporate subsidies in agribusiness is jaw-dropping. And it goes toward agriculture that is just so bad for the environment and actually pretty expensive. What it takes to engineer seed, to copyright it, to get your ad on NPR, ADM, supermarket to the world, poison the water with fertilizers, ship that stuff away from you so that the carrots grown across the road from you get shipped to some plant, cut into baby carrots, brought back to like thousands of miles away, brought back and sold to you as baby carrots in a plastic bag, right? It's a horrible system. And I think we have to understand that at that political level. But that's why when we talk about this artisanal farming, it's sort of like really looking at what is sustainable farming and how is that really sustainable economically and in terms of the world. Those are real solutions. They're not high in the sky or just like, oh, it's a nice lifestyle kind of thing.
Can you wrap up?
I will wrap up. I think about starvation in Ohio. Like, that's sick, you know? Tapping into that kind of anger. When you talked about the global justice movement, someone mentions, you know, 9/11. One reason why the global justice movement went down is that some of these awesome activists did not understand the imperialist nature of our country's response after 9/11. And so the global justice movement fell apart in this whoop to war afterwards. I think that a broader set of politics and a full understanding of these politics is essential to really moving everything forward because it is connected.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for your comments.
Thank you.
Had the brother in the back, followed by Lance.
Hello, my name is Zach. I'm from Portland. One thing I wanted to point out was, I don't know, I always hear the term developing nations that bothers me. Because as long as the status quo supports these nations won't develop, they're smashing into the field of capitalism. And, you know, destroyed, and exploited constantly. And third world solidarity and support is ridiculously important to fighting off this system. There are ways to aid third world nations that are being exploited until there's some sort of like joint dictatorship proletariat of exploited nations. Nothing is going to be done. They need to help them fight back against oppressors.
So, Jordan Lance, I've got the sister in red here.
Yeah, hi, Lance from Chicago. I think that the thing I just wanted to say is I think as socialists, we respond to all these questions or should figure out a way to respond to this question from a class point of view and from a way that we can build solidarity. So I have nothing against anybody having a community garden or buying better food or anything like that. In fact, myself, my partner, we all that stuff ourselves. But we also realize that can only go so far. And what actually Honorata is talking about is a global system. And so how do we respond as socialists in a class point of view? One, you could just throw a few things off the top of my head. I think that what people have spoken to about the global justice movement is a really good example of what we can do to oppose things like CAFTA, like the free trade of the Americas. And the next time the United States government talks about wanting to go feed starving people by invading their country, we have to oppose that. So imposing imperialism in the United States using the excuse of feeding hungry people in Somalia or places like that, we have to oppose it. The next time there's a grocery worker strike, Safeway or whatever, we're on the front lines of supporting that strike to try to get to win. The Los Angeles market struggle you talked about, that's a collective working class struggle, not individual choices, collective working class struggle to defend that institution. Higher food stamps. Get rid of the corporate welfare subsidies and actually use that money to actually to actually feed people. When you talk about the crisis that people are facing all across the country, I mean, food pantries are the demand is skyrocketing every state in the country, and yet they're actually running out of food. And then I just want to end by saying I think that I always find talks about issues like this to be among the best things to convince people about why they need a social solution. Because you can, again, as I said, I have nothing against people taking individual action to do what they can to make their life better, to put better food in their bodies. But at the end of the day, it's getting rid of the system that's actually going to solve the crisis. Karl Marx once said that the biggest condemnation of a system is a system that cannot feed its own slaves. And that, I think, is actually why
you guys
should be a socialist.
Excellent. So I'm gonna try to actually get through this list. I think we can do it. But I'm gonna ask you to keep it to 2 minutes. So at a minute 30, I'll just ask you to wrap up. So if you can try to keep it brief. Got the sister here.
I have a question for the speaker. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the meat societies and people who eat a lot of meat. If they were to eat less meat, would that have a positive effect on global hunger? On global hunger.
Excellent. The brother in green.
I just want to express a disappointment that I have. But when you mentioned that people need to take action and go to the streets, my big disappointment is that my generation is the baby boomer generation. And we took to the streets. I was tear gassed to stop the Vietnam War. It's like my big question is, where did they go? They made change, how many years ago? And they're still here. I wish I knew the answer. It's a disappointment.
Got the brother in white followed by sister by the door.
Would be cool if you could talk a little bit more about your focus on small farmers and assuring a decent life for them and how that fits as a general model for food security for everyone, because I just read, I think, a UN report about how climate change, population growth, decline of water supply, how much all that affects agricultural production, and that we're really in trouble in supplying food to everyone, and additionally, like, that emerging economies, they consume more and more meat, and that's a movement that's really hard to stop. And how are we, just by focusing on small-scale farming, how are we going to produce this huge amount of food for the world's poor?
Sounds good.
Great. We're going to be our last speaker.
I just wanted
I want to talk about Coca-Cola really quickly, just like as an example, because personally, I feel like the environmental movement is a pro-capitalist movement right now, the mainstream, and that's how media is portraying it, that's how the government's portraying it as a pro-capitalist movement, making it economical, which is basically saying propping up capitalism, which is a failed system. But I look at Coca-Cola and I look how they are like trying to market off of this green economy and like how everybody as corporatists are trying to market off of this green economy, right? But that's not what we need. That's not what this society needs, and that's not what we need is socialism, and what we need is, you know, a change in like the whole structure, as we were saying. Like, just the reason I bring up Coca-Cola is because Coca-Cola is an oppressive large corporation that kills people, labor laws, you know, has none, and privatizes water. Babies in Mexico have to drink Coca-Cola just to have clean water. And, like, I personally feel like if I'm walking down the street protesting Coca-Cola, I'm not going to be fucking drinking a Coca-Cola. You know what I mean? Like, just being this, and I know people call it lifestyle politics, making your own decisions about stuff like that, but honestly, just, like, look at it. If you're paying for this Coca-Cola, you're propping up the corporation that you're fighting against. And I just feel like that's our biggest, like, that's what's holding us back. We're fighting these corporations.
Okay, so before I turn it back to Anuradha, I'm going to just make a couple of announcements. Thank you all. We have the Haymarket Bookstore is open in two locations, so if you haven't checked it out yet, people should go down to the auditorium or go over to 110 Cap Street to the other location. Check out the books. There's a lot of new releases right now that people should check out. If you'd like to become a member of the International Socialist Organization or learn more about what it means to join the ISO, the recruitment desk is open, and that's downstairs at the registration table. Don't miss Mark Steele. He's going to be starting his stand-up comedy here in a little bit. So if people want to go check out his stand-up comedy on Che Guevara, The Life of Che Guevara, at 100 Cap Street, the other location. Dinner is not going to be provided, so you'd want to get something on your way over there before you go into the performance. You're welcome to bring that in. And then lastly, be sure to return to the Women's Building, so here tonight at the auditorium, 7 o'clock, for the panel, Proposition 8 is going down. Winning gay marriage in California. And as always, wear your name tag so you can get into meetings. So I'll turn it back to Anuradha.
Okay. Thanks, Eric, and thanks, everyone. Very exciting. I feel like it's been great. I'm picking up ideas and learning so much, so thank you. Apologies to those if I didn't address your question. I'm happy to talk to you later. I did want to address the question of small farmers. You know, for many people, it is like, well, small farmers sounds kind of cool and a nice way to do, but can we feed the world? Just a few, you know, informational facts for you. There's very well hard evidence, well-researched stuff that's out there, which has been published in Nature, to scientific journals, very, very respected, very thorough, rigorous scientific journals, which clearly demonstrates that small farms are far more productive, almost 100% more productive than the large industrial corporate farms, because when you have the large industrial farms, corporate farms, you're growing, you know, your yield might be more in, say, just corn, rows and rows of corn. And it's far more expensive. You had asked a question about water. You know, when you're growing those crops for export, more water, more herbicides, more pesticides, more of everything. And a small farm, when you look at yield per acre, is much higher because a farmer will plant the rows. The area between the rows has other crops growing. There'll be fish, there'll be chicken. So you actually, yield per acre is much more higher. So the small farms are the way to feed the world. And the UNEP report, I don't know if you were mentioning that, that came out that actually last year, again, another report that never, ever was heard of in any of the mainstream newspapers, which said that actually looking at the studies that were done in most of the African countries showed that you would have to grow food organic to feed people in Africa. Given the ecology of the place, given the economics of it, that's the way to feed Africa. So, of course, you didn't hear much about it. And again, it wasn't the Oakland Institute or some commie place putting out a report. It was the UN agencies. So it is the multifunctionality of agriculture, which Europe talks about a lot, that we have to focus on. They provide livelihoods, they're good for the environment, they're the answer to climate change. I mean, nearly 30% of climate change is blamed on the way we do agriculture. Talking about economy, we had done research, sorry, I don't remember the figures. I was involved in it a few years ago. mama's brain, I have a 21-month-old. But we show that you have agricultural system in California. We grow cherry tomatoes, we export them, and then we turn around and import cherry tomatoes. China is the largest producer of table grapes, and we export table grapes from here to China and then turn around and export. Pistachios, we export pistachios to Italy, and then we import pistachios. It's a completely screwed up system, not just environmentally, economically too. So no wonder you have Tulare, Fresno, which are the big agricultural producers. You have the highest rate of hunger among the farm workers. It's a messed up system. We got to fix that. About meat, I was raised a vegetarian. I have never tasted meat in my life. I haven't missed anything in life. I do think you have to eat which is local, regional. You know, if you have a bounty of agricultural produce, and again, I have Indian cuisine. I think nothing compares to that. So it's not a case of fish and chips as our colonizers. So I would say, sorry. Well, you know, people got busy colonizing. They forgot about the cuisine, so they left. But anyway, jokes apart, it's a hard one. It's a personal choice for me to be a vegetarian, and I have become political. When I see what's sold in Safeway, I would rather starve than put it inside my body. I think it's about knowing where your food comes from. If you know that that the duck that you're going to have tonight, if it came from the local farm that's next door, and you know the farmer, and you know what is fed to that duck, go ahead. But if you've ever seen how hogs are raised, forget about your politics. I mean, you would be so grossed out, you wouldn't want to eat it. So I'll just stop at that. Lastly, about disappointment. You know, I can't really answer your question, but I will share what I remember in my work. I've been doing this work for nearly 2 decades now. And my mother once told me a story that I love to tell everyone, and I think it'll be a great way of ending this. You know, a man knew a friend who would go out and light a candle every day at the street corner. She would do it for world peace, she would do it against hunger, she would light a candle. And knowing her for after 10, 20 years, he said, I don't get it. I mean, nothing's changing, things are getting worse, and you keep going out there and lighting that candle. What are you trying to do? You're not changing the world. And she said, I was never trying to change the world. I'm trying to make sure the world doesn't change me. So I'm just trying that the world doesn't change me, and good luck to you all. I hope the world doesn't change you.